Migraine is real. Migraine is a genetic neurologic disease that results in abnormal sensory processing in the brain. And it is also something that we can treat. And the sooner that we can get to diagnosis and optimize treatment, the faster that we can reduce the risk of disease progression. And the faster you can get back to the great life that you have.
Many people with migraine describe light, sound, motion, and even smells as painful or overwhelming. Is migraine at its core a problem of how the brain processes sensory input? And if so, what can we do about it? Today, we're joined by Dr. Amal Starling from the Mayo Clinic to unpack the science and day-to-day strategies that help. Dr. Starling, welcome back to the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you so much, Carl. I always love being at the Migraine World Summit year after year, so I'm excited to be here again. And a very exciting topic.
Well, we love having you. Dr. Starling, what is a sensory processing disorder and how is it usually defined?
Yeah, so a sensory processing disorder, or sometimes it's actually referred to as a sensory processing difference, if it does not meet the threshold of a disorder or resulting in abnormal function. But in the most general of terms, what it is all the different sensory stimuli that are coming into our body from our external environment and even from our internal environment, from inside of our body. When that stimuli is not being processed in the normal pathways and the normal function, then that can result in a difference or a sensory processing disorder. And it doesn't just mean a hyper response to stimulation, but actually it could also be an under response to stimulation. So there may be individuals who to touch may jump, or individuals where to touch, you have to rub them more and more before they're able to sense that you are touching them. So it could either be a hyper response to sensory stimulation, or it could be an under response to sensory stimulation. I also think it's important to think about what sensory stimuli are we talking about? Because it's not just the five sensory stimuli or sensations that we learned about, you know, way back in grade school, right? Our sight, our hearing, our touch, our smell, our taste. But also, what about our vestibular stimuli that we get? What about motion? Are we processing motion appropriately? There are individuals who may feel like there's constantly this abnormal sense of motion when they truly are still. What about proprioception? This is the sensation that we have that we know where our body is in space. And that may be differently processed in certain individuals. Interoception, meaning the way that we are responding to our internal stimuli, hunger, thirst, temperature, all of those things. And then the last one, which is very important, especially for the topic of migraine, is nociception or pain perception. So those are all the different stimuli that could potentially have a hyper response or an under response, resulting in a sensory processing difference or a disorder if it's resulting in dysfunction.
Should people with migraine think of as migraine as an official sensory processing disorder, or is it more a neurological condition that includes sensory processing differences, problems, or disorders?
You know, I think that as we have an understanding of what migraine is right now, and what we know about migraine is that it has a genetic cause, right? So it's a genetic neurologic disease that has many internal and external factors that influence the severity of the disease, as well as just the prevalence of the disease. A person having it or a person not having it, whether they have the genes or not, can depend on all of those factors. And in people with migraine, there is abnormal function of the brain. And the abnormal function of the brain is this abnormal sensory processing. So I don't think migraine as a field has yet defined itself as a sensory processing disorder. However, definitely as a field, from a clinical perspective and from a clinical trial and scientific perspective, an anatomic neuroimaging perspective, we have evidence that shows, an overwhelming amount of evidence that shows, that the abnormal function in migraine is abnormal processing of sensations, not just pain, right? In the migraine world, we always say it's not just headache. There are so many other symptoms that are involved in migraine. And that's why it's an abnormal processing of all these different sensations that's resulting in the clinical phenotype of what migraine looks like in individual patients.
Do we know why there's abnormal processing of this normal sort of stimuli, like light, noise, and smells? Why can they feel so intense or painful for people with migraine?
We know why it happens to a certain degree from some clinical trials that have been done. So if we're asking why is it happening based on the science, we know that there have been what we call electrophysiologic studies that have been done. And in these studies, we are looking at the electrical response to sensory stimulation. So for example, if someone is given some certain visual stimulation, there's a specific brain electrical response, a visual evoked potential that we can measure. And we know that in individuals with migraine, whether they're having an attack or even in between attacks, so interictal, meaning when they're not having a migraine attack, that they have a different response, a different electrical response to that sensory stimulation or that visual stimulation. We also know that in individuals with migraine compared to healthy controls, when we expose someone in a healthy control to the combination of touch and light together versus migraine, it is processed abnormally and differently in those individuals who have migraine. There's also something else called a habituation deficit that is present in individuals with migraine. So clinically, what that means is in individuals who don't live with migraine, if they're in a room where there is a light that is slightly flickering, they may notice it when they first enter the room, but guess what? Their brain habituates to it and they no longer notice it. You walk into a room and you may hear a slight hum, but an individual not living with migraine, it'll just cancel out and they no longer hear it. However, in individuals with migraine, they don't habituate to that repetitive stimulation. It is constantly fresh and new and intrusive and potentially painful for those individuals. And that's also been demonstrated in a laboratory level as well with different like blink reflexes, where if you're giving someone a stimulation near their eye and a protective reflex is to blink, but if you continue that stimulation and the brain learns, oh, this is actually not going to be dangerous, individuals with migraine will stop the blink reflex. But individuals living with migraine, they can't habituate to that.
Migraine, we know, is a condition that affects a lot of people differently and in terms of severity as well. Does that also suggest that as migraine becomes more chronic and more frequent, that these sensory processing difficulties become more pronounced? And then likewise, if we perhaps improve or we reduce our frequency of attacks, or maybe we become episodic and we go into remission from chronic migraine, does that also show that perhaps our sensitivity to some of these sensory processing inputs or at least the processing mechanisms can improve as well?
Yeah, such a good question. And it really kind of refers to the plasticity of the brain and how much can we wire up that sensitivity of all of those pathways, or really the gain, right? The amplitude of all of those pathways. And then can we actually go in the opposite direction? And what is beautiful about the brain? It is very, very plastic. The plasticity of the brain is what leads to chronification and transformation, right? Frequent attacks that are untreated or at least unoptimized in their treatment can lead to chronification. It can lead to strengthening of all those pathways. And we now have evidence that shows that in neuroimaging studies, that we're able to differentiate in functional neuroimaging studies healthy controls, not only for migraine, but also look at the spectrum of migraine and differentiate function in episodic migraine, high frequency episodic migraine, chronic migraine, even to the point of actually seeing some microstructural changes in the brain as well, in addition to the functional changes. And what we're hoping to see is that we'll eventually have data that shows that we can reverse those processes. Now, from a clinical perspective, we do know that in many individuals, we are able to reverse those processes. But honestly, my approach would be preventing getting to that point in the first place, which is why our focus is on screening, on a diagnosis, and an early treatment. And migraine in many individuals starts when individuals are children, right? So really increasing the focus on screening and diagnosis and optimization of treatment of migraine in pediatrics is hopefully going to reduce the chronification of migraine that we see in many adults.
Some patients describe allodynia when touch itself becomes painful. Do we know what's happening in the brain when that occurs, and why does that matter?
Yeah, so allodynia is a biomarker for what we call central sensitization. So first of all, allodynia is when non-painful touch becomes painful. And this can be present in individuals with migraine during an attack. We also have data that shows that even in between an attack, interictally, that people can experience allodynia as well. And the allodynia can be present on the head and neck area, but also can be extracranial too, even on the body, anywhere on the body. I have some patients with chronic migraine, many, many years of chronic migraine, who will tell me they feel their clothes. This is another one of those concepts of a habituation deficit, right? In general, most people don't feel that they're necessarily wearing clothes because we habituate to it. But some people living with migraine and who may have high degrees of that hyper-responsiveness to touch and may have a lot of allodynia will even feel their clothes, and it's uncomfortable for some of the patients. So what is central sensitization? It is when those brain pathways are really strong, that pain matrix has become really strong. I think about the pain matrix kind of like a muscle. And we go to work out at the gym and we exercise to strengthen those muscles. What strengthens those pain pathways is recurrent migraine attacks, especially when they're untreated or poorly optimized in their treatment. Those pain pathways become very strong. There's a process of central sensitization that occurs, and that is what can lead to things like allodynia. And it's important to identify allodynia in patients because we know from a treatment perspective, there are certain medications that can reverse allodynia, and there are certain medications that may not work as well when allodynia is present because they don't reverse allodynia. So that may help me and my patient come up with a shared decision treatment plan for their migraine attacks.
You don't have to take it in all at once. You can return to extended interviews at your own pace with the All Access Pass. Sensory processing differences are also common in conditions like autism and ADHD. How is migraine similar and how is it different?
Well, one of the things that's similar is that they often coexist together, right? So if you look at populations on autism with autism spectrum disorders, there is a higher percentage of individuals with migraine compared to the general population. Same applies for ADHD. Same applies for a lot of other disease states where there's abnormal function. Pain states like fibromyalgia, there can be other even abdominal pain, functional dyspepsia, a lot of those other conditions that involve abnormal function are comorbid with migraine. So what does that mean? I think we haven't yet uncovered it all, but obviously there's going to be a genetic overlap that we will eventually discover. The genetics of migraine, I feel like, are still quite a bit in its infancy. What we have now are over 100 different genes with over hundreds of different genetic variations that can lead to genetic vulnerability to migraine disease. And many of those genes likely overlap with some of these other sensory processing disorders or differences.
We also know that migraine is more common in people with these conditions. Why does the research, or what does the research show about, you know, these overlaps and why they may exist?
Yeah, so I really think it comes down to the genetics and what those genes are doing to the function of the brain. And so in individuals with autism spectrum disorder, individuals with autism spectrum disorder that's resulting in abnormal sensory processing, those genetic abnormalities are leading to that abnormal sensory processing, and there may be shared pathways with individuals who have migraine. But then in individuals with migraine, they also have shared genetic pathways to individuals with chronic pain conditions like fibromyalgia. And so there's likely a lot of different overlaps, which is why there is so much, the amount of genetic heterogeneity or differences that exist in all individuals living with migraine is why migraine looks so different in its clinical phenotype in person to person. It also explains why there's not a one treatment that addresses all individuals living with migraine, because everyone's migraine disease is a little bit different.
It seems as well in ADHD and autism that these changes tend to occur in early development, like in childhood, and they seem to be relatively fixed throughout their life. Like they can learn tools and they can sort of have treatments and so forth, but it's fairly inflexible. Whereas with migraine, it feels like these sensory processing differences can come and go along with the severity and the disease progression or improvement a little bit more. So there's, in that sense, for migraine, there's quite a bit of hope to have in regards to, you know, managing.
That is so true. And it's, you know, so important to talk about how you can go in both directions. And it's just human nature that if something is uncomfortable, you want to avoid it. So I have patients for whom light is very, very uncomfortable because they have a hyper response to that visual stimulation. And sometimes in those individuals, as their disease progresses, they may avoid light more and more and more. But unfortunately, our brains and our sensory systems are built to seek out sensory stimulation. And so as someone is avoiding light, the sensory gain on those light pathways is actually increasing. So as they're avoiding light, they're becoming more sensitive to light. And so we often have to really do a desensitization therapy for some of these patients, an exposure therapy where they bring them back into light slowly over time, to try to normalize those gains at the same time that we're trying to treat all the other abnormal function of the brain with all the tools that we have in our toolbox. But we have a program here, our chronic pain rehabilitation program, which really is about bringing a lot of my patients who have chronic migraine, who are living in the dark and in the quiet, back into the light and back into the normal sounds, ambient sounds that are present, so that hopefully we're able to reverse those processes of hyper-responsiveness. Avoiding it makes it worse. We really need to try to normalize function of those areas, but then also desensitize the spaces. And, you know, one of the things that people can be aware of, or senses that people can be aware of, is just postural changes. And I find that a lot of my patients with migraine are very hyper-responsive to postural changes, where being upright is uncomfortable for them. And then it results in them being not upright and really being bedbound frequently. And that actually ends up having a lot of deconditioning challenges that worsens the picture. But I found that from an exercise perspective, is that if we can explore how can people exercise without forcing themselves to be upright by doing a lot of recumbent exercise, where we can start with a recumbent bike, or we can start with water exercises, which seems to really help. I think because it provides a good amount of sensory stability, right? When you're in the water, you have, it's almost like a full body compression with the water. But I find that my patients with migraine do well with starting with water exercises and starting with recumbent exercises, even strength training, again, in the recumbent position. So figuring out a way to be able to engage in that therapeutic aspect of exercise in a way that doesn't increase discomfort is something we really work with our patients on.
What are some of the most useful environmental changes for people around light, sound, smell, and motion?
The biggest thing is stability, right? Is that you want to try to really reduce the amount of changes that you have in your external and your internal environment. Now, that's hard because that means that I'm telling my patients to basically live in a bubble and not do anything. And that's obviously the exact opposite of what I want my patients to do. But I empower my patients to think about migraine as a threshold disease, right? And all those different internal and external factors can affect that threshold. And they have control to modulate some of those factors. So for example, if there's a change in weather, well, that's not something that we can change. But if there's a change in weather, the threshold drops. But if people know, like right now in, I'm located in Scottsdale, Arizona, and in Arizona, we're in monsoon season. And during this season, there's a lot of barometric pressure changes. And for my patients with migraine, this is a vulnerable time period for them. So their threshold is lower, but this is the time where they can optimize stability in their sleep schedule, optimize their eating schedule, optimize their hydration, optimize their regular exercise. And those things will help actually raise that threshold so that they can build some more stability back into their day-to-day environments. And the same applies with really all of those things that people feel might be triggers for changing that threshold and vulnerability of having their next attack.
We have another talk this year talking entirely about vestibular migraine, but for people who experience dizziness and motion, is that a sensory processing disorder, and what approaches can make a difference there?
The vestibular senses is another one of those five plus senses that we have. Having good vestibular sense is knowing that my body is not moving when it's not moving. Knowing that my body is moving when it is moving. Knowing that the environment around me, if I'm sitting in a car and I'm driving, that the environment around me is moving. Knowing that, or if I'm not driving in a car and I'm just sitting there parked in this parking lot and knowing that it's not moving, all of those things are senses. And individuals who have vestibular migraine have abnormal processing of that sense of motion. They may feel like they're constantly moving. They may have an internal sense of motion or even an external sense of motion. In fact, a large cohort of my patient population are individuals who present after they've gone to maybe 2 or 3 or 7 ENTs because they're dizzy. And these are often women that are in their 40s to 50s. So around that perimenopausal time period where they will actually develop vestibular symptoms. And when they come and we do a full history, these are often individuals who have had a history of migraine that has been undiagnosed their entire life. But now their migraine symptoms are associated with more of these vestibular symptoms, plus or minus pain. Some of them don't even have any pain associated with it. Some of them may have more mild pain, but the vestibular symptoms are what's most disconcerting. I see a lot of those patients, and they're so worried that there is, you know, something that is more alarming from a structural perspective that is resulting in the symptoms that they have. The good news is, you know, for the treatment of vestibular migraine, in general, they respond to a lot of our general migraine treatment options. And we even have some studies with our novel therapeutics specifically for vestibular migraine with some of the CGRP targeted medications, which have had good results in those patients.
That's a great lead in to talk about treatments and management strategies. So is it fair then to say that if we get a treatment that reduces our migraine attacks, we can expect it to help at least to some degree with our sort of sensory overload as well?
With treatment, our hope is all of those things will improve and that we raise that threshold so that individuals are allowed to live the life that they want to live. And they may have some exposure to different external and internal triggers, but it doesn't reach the threshold of triggering a migraine attack. Now, we don't have a cure for migraine. So in addition to always having preventive treatment options to raise that threshold, every person with migraine should also have rescue treatment options for when that threshold is overcome and an attack occurs, that we're able to treat that attack effectively and rapidly.
You spoke earlier about neuroplasticity. Beyond medication, are there skills or habits like sleep, exercise, mindfulness that can actually raise the brain's tolerance to sensory input over time?
There are studies that have shown cognitive behavioral therapy, biofeedback, progressive muscle relaxation, mindfulness, all of these therapies can be very, very helpful from a preventive perspective. And some studies that show that even during an acute attack, biofeedback or progressive muscle relaxation can be helpful to stop an individual attack. What's interesting is we started this conversation about the overlap between sensory processing disorders like autism spectrum disorders, ADHD, fibromyalgia, all these different disorders where there's abnormal processing of sensations, including migraine. And when you think about the non-medication approaches at how we can treat migraine based on evidence, you see that there is actually quite a bit of overlap. A lot of those spaces can benefit from physical therapy, occupational therapy, exposure therapy, CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy. Mindfulness can be very helpful for all of those states, can really help people feel grounded to where they are in space and in their environment.
If someone's having kind of an acute episode of, you know, be it migraine or just sensory overload, what's something that they can do to just try and sort of, you know, get through that situation to bring things down a notch?
Yeah. I think biofeedback is such an incredible tool that really all of us humans can optimize so that we can use that. When someone is in that place of sensory overload, it really increases that hypervigilance and throws that individual into a fight or flight mode. And when we are in fight or flight, we are even more responsive to all of the stimulation around us. And it makes sense because if we were truly running from a bear or danger, we would want to be very sensitive to light, sound, smell, pain, everything around us so that we could survive. However, in this state, when they have sensory overload and they can feel that they have initiated a migraine attack, it really is important to be able to not only use the tools they have available, whether they be medications or devices, but also use biofeedback to be able to modulate that autonomic nervous system. The autonomic nervous system is that fight or flight, and the opposite of it is the rest and digest. So the sympathetic nervous system is the fight or flight, and then the parasympathetic is the rest and digest. And that should always be in a yin and yang nice balance. However, in that place of sensory overload, our fight or flight is just up the roof, right? Through the roof. And so if we can practice boxed breathing techniques or other biofeedback techniques and paced respirations, that actually tries to normalize that balance between the fight or flight system and the rest and digest. So using the tools that you have available, that you have established with your healthcare professional for the acute attack, but then also using all of those, be empowered to use all the tools that you have control over to try to bring back normalcy to that balance between fight or flight and rest and digest.
What's the most important message you'd like people to take away about migraine and sensory processing?
Well, the number one message that I want patients with migraine to take away is that migraine is real. Migraine is a genetic neurologic disease that results in abnormal sensory processing in the brain. And it is also something that we can treat. And the sooner that we can get to diagnosis and optimize treatment, the faster that we can reduce the risk of disease progression. And the faster you can get back to the great life that you have.
Dr. Starling, thank you for your time and expertise today in covering a topic that we've never covered before on the Migraine World Summit. We greatly appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much for having me again, Carl.